And I think we'll work on that officially. We have, on November 7th, a Tuesday, and I'll supply you with later details on that whole thing. We had a very fascinating speaker who has honored us with his presence here this evening, Henry Sapeco, 2 weeks ago, and you haven't forgotten him. And he gave us one side of the argument, dialectics of liberation. And of course, in the polarity of life and thought, we must have the dialectics of slavery. Now, Mr. George Tomey, our lecturer this evening, is a brilliant young instructor of philosophy, and he talks eloquently, especially on Hegel. I don't know whether he gave him mine or not, but it'll be most interesting for me to find out whether he'll bring God, nature, and man together, and the old Hegelian trinity may once again be resurrected. But he's going to correct me, I am sure. The little blurb we have is as accurate as I could possibly come to. He does teach at the University of Bridgeport, and he's taking courses there, and also can lecture on the drop of a hat, if you will, on any subject in philosophy, eloquently, fluently, challengingly, and engagingly. At any rate, you'll be witness to that this evening. If I were to say more, I'm sure he would begin to blush, but certainly his future augurs exceedingly well. And beyond that, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. George Tomey.
Well, I don't know whether I can live up to the topic or the introduction, but I'll try. Oftentimes, our departure isn't from what we believe or accept. It's from what we can't deny. Philosophers have argued over whether they were facing a wall or not facing a wall. They were seeing a tree or not seeing a tree. But they very seldom have ever argued over the fact whether they have been burnt or they have not been burnt. And I think in the intellectual history of mankind that we are faced with a similar situation of what we can't deny. And this is that in the history of mankind's intellectual growth, that four men have played a leading role, a seminal role, for our century. These were Freud, Marx, Einstein, and Darwin. With Darwin, we had the theory of evolution, which connected man with the animal world. With Einstein, we had the theory of relativity, which brought man into connection with his own ideas of truth. And we have the theory of Marx, which brought out the social nature of mankind. And we have the theory of Freud, which brings out the theory of the unconscious human behavior and pattern of thinking. Now, I'd like to start by separating two from the other two, that is Freud and Marx, and point out the commonality here. With the four, we have a commonality of the unity of nature, the dismissal of the idea that we are separated from the animal world, the theory that we're dismissed from our equations with Einstein, the theory that we're dismissed from our body by Freud, and our dismissal of the idea that of other human beings from our thinking. Now, with what Freud called in his system oppression, repression, Marx called it oppression. And briefly, I'd like to give you a diagrammatic explanation of Freud's theory and then interrelate the two thinkers. With Freud, you have a theory that mankind has repressed himself through his culture
in a horizontal fashion from all objects into a center of the, I'm speaking now from the male perspective, it could be spoken from the female perspective also. We've been pushed off the totality of the world, an erotic alignment and attachment to the entire world into a female object. And we've also been repressed vertically inside of ourselves to the genital region. This, so that we end up fixated in a certain point.
This is not the clinical Freud, this is the metapsychological Freud. The clinical Freudians have taught that mankind should go through adjustment phases and end happily up at the expectations of civilization. But with the metapsychology, what he called beyond the psychology, that's what that word means, he did speculate and make attempts to go beyond what was necessary to repair people and send them back into society. Marx saw that man was driven along the same type of a matrix from his fellow man and from his theories and from the earth that he lived in. He was driven into an idealistic dimension. So that man was alienated from both his thought and from the world that he lived in and from his fellow man. So we have a matrix suiting both of their thinking. Side by side with the development of civilization, we've had the development of culture. A culture that is invested since Paleolithic times, the earliest times that we know of that man was on Earth, with a magio-religious dimension to it. The caves at Altamira, you know, were paintings of animals for magio-religious purposes. It was, so to speak, the first shrine or church or whatever you have. And that these served a definite purpose. But in the history of mankind, as civilization develops, as the dialectics of oppression develop, we begin to separate the relations between things. We separate art from social struggle. We separate social struggle from the body. We start dividing things and pushing them apart. And we develop the specialist point of view, the point of view that knows only the locus of points that it is surrounded by and not the organic unity of nature. In the history of mankind, for instance, art has played a particular role of collaboration with the very elements that are a dipole, one of the ends of the system of slavery. During the period of the Middle Ages, for instance, you had a great deal of attention paid to the, I'm not speaking of the Renaissance period, but you had a great deal of attention paid to the depreciation of the body and the figure of Christ, the saints, the suffering, the masochism. And artists freely entered into this and did not consider that they were reflecting a certain psychology and a certain metaphysics of the age. We're all familiar with the trite angels who even have wings on their head. You have a complete annihilation of the rest of the body, a complete annihilation of the very identity of a human being. And today we have refinements of this that also lead one to believe that he's separated and isolated. But if we look back and try to gain a perspective, we can't quite accept that theory. Archaeologists, anthropologists are capable of looking at any piece of pottery, any painting, any sculpture, the minutest fragment, and they can place that exactly within a few hundred years, less than 100 years, without the aid of the carbon-14 test, which gives a scientific verification. They can tell what reign of a king that an art object appeared in, exactly what stage of history they were going through. And yet today when we paint or when we create sculpture or when we indulge in any form of art, we go into it considering that we're bringing an entirely different individuality into the art. I am doing something that no one else has done. I'm creating a representation of a thought that no one else has thought. And what we're doing in many cases is chasing a myth that's grounded on the dialectic of slavery, of the division of nature, the division of mankind, from all the points that I've described on the board there. And that what we're dealing with, rather than individuality, is we're dealing with currents and the dynamics of civilization. Now, I separated the first two thinkers that I brought up, Freud and Marx, from Darwin and Einstein, so that I could bring this point in at this stage, that the common element between these two thinkers with the rest of the group is that they all believe in a current, a flow, a general law that can be applied. And it's the general interpretation that has created the very essence of their contribution to the history of mankind's thought, not the segregation of areas into complete uniqueness. Now, we can also focus many other thinkers into this area. I'm talking about a center. There were people that led into this. There's Hegel, whom he mentioned before. Hegel created the onslaught against the hold of Aristotle on Western thought. Up to that time, mankind was so strong in holding to the idea that he could separate things, that he invented as systems of logic and systems of philosophy that tore all types of things apart and united them together on the basis of myth, fiction, and ectoplasm. This is a fictional reality to explain the unity of nature. And Hegel came along and he decided that from what the sciences had been discovering at that time, that you couldn't make these type of divisions. That you couldn't put plants in one area and put animals in another area. That there was whole areas of interpenetration. In zoology today we know that there are animals that have both chloroplasts, that manufacture food, and they also eat food. We know that there's molecules that can reproduce themselves, like a common sugar molecule, Gamow says, can reproduce itself. So that whatever element that we take to define, he says, separately from all the rest of nature, we can find a whole zone where this whole definition falls apart. And he created a system of fluid concepts. He called it dialectics. And what are the laws of dialectics? The laws of dialectics are that there's an interpenetration of opposites. There's an interpenetration of all things. That all things are interconnected, interrelated, and interdependent. That the universe that we live in, as Whitehead says, could be disturbed by the motion of our hand, the entire universe. We're only measuring a decrease of influence, never talking about a totality of influence, nor are we speaking of a complete absence of influence. Now I'd like to bring Marx into the picture. The theory of Marx is basically misunderstood and is basically not represented on the face of this planet. Marx's theory is the theory that mankind left a primordial stage where he held his property in common. He didn't have property, so he didn't even hold it in common. They hunted on the ground together. They borrowed items from each other. They had no limitations on the expanse of man's potential. But with the development of agriculture, you had a possibility for a few people to live without doing anything and the rest of the people to do it for you. And so we had a division of mankind into two definite distinct groups. These groups were basically on the one hand, the witch doctor, whom Ayn Rand has made quite a case of, if anyone's read Ayn Rand, and the chieftain. And on the other hand, you have the people that are producing and who are creating the labor and the products of the civilization. Now, we can retie Freud into this. I hope I'm not jumping from thinker to thinker too fast for you. But you see, there had to be an organic unity to this. You couldn't just separate man into one group. You couldn't make pharaohs of one group and slaves of another group without creating some type of a bomb, a medication to satisfy this. And so we had the arrival of art and the arrival of religion. And we can combine them together in a very descriptive phrase, I feel, magio-religious. That they began to serve magio-religious functions. We began to believe that we could compel nature through the symbols. And to a certain extent today, this the last hole of this, we're holding on to it in mathematics, which still believes that we can compel nature by symbols. But in the, all the other areas, there is a sliding away from this because of the fact that we're arriving at a state of civilized fruition, a state where mankind, in other words, has achieved so much potential to liberate himself that he's unconsciously striving to regroup his forces in the original unity that he experienced in Paleolithic times. Dialectics itself is a theory that you cannot have anything without its opposite. You can't have theory without a body, you cannot have, which does not create theory. You cannot have insides without outsides. You cannot have up without a down. You cannot have anything without a contrast. But yet we create ideals independent of this concept. We create in the sense that we believe that there is an absolute individual. We believe in freedom in a vacuum. But these things are more magio-religious thoughts and conceptions. Now, in the realm of Freud, you have an unusual situation. Here was a man who explored so much of the liberation of mankind, so much of the enslavement of mankind according to the culture which had driven him into the center, and yet at the same time he made a basic commitment to the culture that created the oppression. Now, in Freud's system, you have a dialectical struggle between reality on the one hand, which I'll represent by R, and pleasure pain analysis on the other. The pleasure pain analysis as a biological reality, it's still spoken of in biology classes. This is that primitive protoplasm will move toward a favorable chemical situation, will move away from an adverse. They call this aversion reaction. Now, even though Freud's system is declared as outmoded, we find it even hanging on in the system of Skinner and his system of conditioning and behaviorism, because ultimately they have to tie down the behavior of the dog to the food or the beneficial element that it'll give him. Now, what happened, Freud says, is that that the human race could never have just the pleasure-pain analysis of reality. That if it just ran away from things that were bad and moved toward things that were good, it would be destroyed because there weren't enough good things in the world for mankind at that stage. And some of the painful things would come back and destroy it, the animals, the environment, etc. So he had to face this reality. So he created a buffer zone. Now, in his system, he speaks of an ego as a mediator between pleasure-pain analysis, which he calls the id, and the reality principle over here. He also was aware that we just didn't build up an ego per se, a demarcation of territory called me that sits opposed to the world and sits opposed to my instincts, some rational academic being. But we created a whole reinforcement of this buffer zone. We created art. We created an art that could satisfy, could be a compensation for withdrawing from a pleasure-pain analysis, and at the same time serve as a buffer to the reality, so that we could still stay near it, but yet be detached to it from a certain extent. Now, of course, people, if they were caught in the situation of just fleeing and moving toward pleasure and pain, we would have had not the basis for constructing this intermediary zone here. We could not have constructed the art. And so we tied Marx in again, that a group of people were separated from the great masses of people, who were free from labor. These were the priests, the aristocrats, the nobles, who did create the art. And in creating the art, he says they also created an ideology within the art. They created the idea of the ideal world. And from earliest times, the tomb at Cheops, I think, was created 3000 BC. You had the idea that a man could take a boat, lock it inside a bunch of stones, and take off for another world. Now, it's
I just wanted to bring out another point. That, you know, that laws were attached to art at one time. I don't know if you're familiar with this. That in many, many, many civilizations, such as in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, there were definite laws which an artist could not exceed. For instance, in Egypt, you were forbidden to make the face of anyone but the pharaoh during certain stages. And this was complied with. Nothing but the figure of the pharaoh. And so, you see that we don't have quite the isolation of the artist from the milieu, from the general circumstances of civilization as we'd like to believe sometimes. That oftentimes they present a situation we found that was similar in our own 20th century. People criticized the scientists in Nazi Germany, such as Wernher von Braun, for creating rockets for Hitler. Well, they were creating artistic rockets for the pharaoh a long time ago, so that we can't consider any particular aspect of our civilization separate from the whole dialectic of slavery, that art is involved in it, the science to a certain extent, and the political area, and all other areas of discipline. So that the division we make sometimes between the role of the artist and the role of the scientist in civilization is an arbitrary division. We've got to return to an organic view of mankind, an organic conception of the parts played by man and the goals that are to be achieved by mankind. The dialectics of slavery, in a simple phrase, depends on fragmentation. It depends on alienation of man from man, depends on alienation of man from the nature that he lives in, the universe he lives in, and from the ideas that he thinks. Now, most of our culture is based on the theory that man is born, he's brought up, he develops, and goes through stages, just to add another bit of thought to a pile of increasing thoughts. And that we sort of have a tyranny separating the two things. A man exists only to add to an academic treasure. We have academics that create books for more academics, scientists who create problems for more scientists, people who write novels for novelists to improve on, artists who create techniques for technique to be improved on. And we have a total schism taking place in our culture. And this schism tends to make us overlook, we can all take refuge in certain areas of the matrix. We can take refuge, say, as a Dutch painter over here painting a certain object. You see, we're regathering the matrix. As I said before, this represents all objects. This was the world of objects. This is the world of the body. What happens is that you could have Dutch painting, you could paint still life, you could paint apples, oranges, you could paint houses, you could paint all types of objects, paint animals, etc. And this is some magical religious way of regaining what we've been driven off of, so to speak, in the theory of Freud in particular, and also, if anyone's read the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts, which is one of the most enlightened things that Marx did write, it was the least propagandistic of his writings. And we also had an attempt to retrieve the body. And this has gone strangely through ebbs and flows. It hasn't been something that's been constant. And none of this is there just a linear development. There is great tides of successes in certain areas and then retreats. We had bastions of light, say for instance in ancient Greece, in the Renaissance, in the classical period of France. Then we had great retreats take place. I'm speaking now not of technology per se. I'm speaking of a dialectic of liberation, which I think Henry covered. That we gained a certain advance in these areas, but we're always going through a withdrawal also at the same time. And what happens, the artist reflects us in the realm of objects, and he also could reflect it in the realm of the body. And as I mentioned before, that if we were to not imagine this as a diagram, I'm not an artist myself, but I'll draw a stick figure here, sort of draw it in there, that you have an emaciated figure. I could draw that hanging on a cross. I bet in the medieval period it would have been an acceptable representation of man. Any force that could depreciate the human body and represent the masochism of the drama of Christianity was an acceptable form of art. And you also have certain chapels. The areas are loaded with the heads cut off. As you know, that part of the dialectics of slavery, Lindner pointed out. Dr. Lindner wrote a book called Prescription for Rebellion, and he said it was no accident that in 1984 they had an anti-sex league. See, this was a complete picture of tyranny. And for those of you that have read it, you'll remember that they had an anti-sex league. They forbade it. They depreciated the contact of one man with another woman in this instance here, Julia and Winston. And they tried to control the sexuality of mankind, Lindner says, because if you can control the sexuality of mankind, you can control his thinking. And I'd like to reverse that a bit and say that if you can, taking the individual and not taking it from the analysis of a master and a slave, if the individual, now taking this matrix as the individual, that if you can actually bring yourself to accept the fact that you're not trying to regain the exterior elements, that this is where you're satisfied, you see, then you can fool yourself at the intellectual level too. If you can fool yourself instinctually, then you can fool yourself intellectually. There's a great capability of transisting over there. We have this problem in civilization today in the 20th century. I like to keep it within the area of 20th century problems. People have brought up the question, how could a man hoe his own cabbage patch in Nazi Germany and then have all of that terror take place? Well, it's very easy. You can see it in our own civilization, the dialectic of it. That if all your life your parents bringing you up to say, this is what is expected of you, this is what you must do, you must be sensible, you must be realistic. This is when they're saying realistic. Now remember that they're just giving a watered down version of what Freud was talking about, the opposition of the pleasure principle to the reality principle. But they don't say this. They say it to you. You see, we bring Marx back into the picture again. We idealize it. In other words, we make theoretical what is concrete. We talk about a world of ideas when we mean a world of objects. That they say you must be realistic in your assessment. So they're driving you over to an abandonment of your own identity. And they tell you that your identity is found over here. The very thing that is contradicting yourself. The very thing that is the dipole, two poles, two poles. The very end of the dipole, which the whole dialectic of civilization, no less the dialectic of liberation and the dialectic of slavery, is opposing. Now, you can see the situation, that we can transist the training, the ordinary training that you get, the training that tells you to face this reality, the theory that you live in a world of practicality, a world of utilitarianism. And you know, they have whole philosophies about this. They have utilitarianism. That means what's useful is good. They have a system called pragmatism. Pragmatism means that what works is good. And so anything that doesn't work isn't good, I imagine, and anything that isn't useful isn't true. And where does that take your system of art? And where is that taking our civilization is the bigger question. Where is theories of practicality and utilitarianism taking our civilization? Well, if someone could look into the situation objectively, we're subjectively evolved to a certain stage, but I think that if we try to understand the magnitude of the problem, we sort of can transcend what we're blocking out. Like I said before, it's a question of what you can't deny, not a question of what you want to admit or a question of what you want to accept, because you can end into problems. Do I accept the existence of this here in front of my hand? I can raise a whole battery of questions that would make it doubtful. But if one of you were to come up and punch me in the nose, it's not something I think I would create a philosophy around how that fist didn't strike me in the nose. Well, if we look at it with this intensity, we can see that from 1900 to 1960, we've had nothing but war, and nothing but the preparation for war. And yet they keep saying that our civilization is based on sound principles, it's based on morality, moralism, and it's based on all sorts of real tried and tested things. You've heard the conservative theory that we believe what's tried and tested, what's been proven through the centuries. Well, we're taking the things that have been proven through the centuries, and we seem to have nothing but epidemics of war taking place. After we get into the 20s, we can look back at 1918, 1917, and we say, oh, wasn't that foolish? I wouldn't have taken part in that. That was just a struggle between a Kaiser and a king. It's so ridiculous. And then we have an eruption of the Second World War. And then social scientists go to work and they say, oh, if they'd only done this, they'd only had done this, if they'd only, and it's as if it's a question of onlys, of only. But you see, it's not a question of onlys. It's a question of a radical rupture with certain assumptions that we've accepted without question. Now, some of us consider it a great liberation of the mentality to throw off the belief that there's other figures sitting up in the sky, that there's a God that is concerned with what you think and what you say and what you do. But we don't ever cross the gap of cutting off the whole foundation. Everything in a certain sense is built architecturally. We live in an artistic culture. The scientists say that what they created is artistic all the time. I hear, like for instance, I took a symbolic logic course, and they said that, oh, there's beauty in the system when you can say that A implies B, and that you can go down and make a whole bunch of formulas like that. And then the mathematicians say the same thing, that when I can juggle a whole bunch of numbers around, it's beautiful. And then you're in the school here and you're creating things, and it's, maybe you're not saying it's beautiful because you're more sophisticated, you're more withdrawn from direct emotional assessments of your work or fears of your work, whichever it may be. So you unconsciously look at it. It's irrelevant whether in this method that I'm saying. Someone the other night told me that he wants to be a famous artist. And he wants to be, you know, someone that will stand out. You see, he's expressing the very problem that I was speaking of earlier, the problem of wanting to be fragmented. Let's have the whole universe, nothing but a bunch of things floating off in space, and now have our bodies floating out there and have everything dismembered. You see, we're still playing out, and intellectually, this is a play out of a masochistic, sadistic syndrome. Since we're being dismembered, we want to extrovert it, we want to put it outside of ourselves and dismember everything around us, including ourselves. And we find more safety in everything flying apart rather than looking at it unified, because you get caught in your thinking again. You start looking at a matrix. And you see that many, many great thinkers, as I pointed out today, that how can a thinker escape from a theory of relativity and truth, a question of evolution and matter, the universe, the dynamics of reality? How can he escape from the social nature of mankind? And on this point here, some people would tend to be a little bit skeptical. But the worst punishment that you can give an individual is to put him in solitary confinement. This is known by any criminologist, or any, I should say, because it isn't the criminologist, it's any administrator of a system of tyranny called a prison, can tell you that if you put a man and leave him alone, that that's going to be the worst suffering that he can ever endure. That if you leave him alone long enough, he'll go insane. His whole thinking process will collapse. So when we keep championing a fragmented concept of individuality, I'll get to a moment on what is what is a good concept of it, as much as could be said for that theory, because once a word has gone out so far, it gets very difficult to even discuss the word. That is, and also with the fourth point here, the theory of the unconscious. Now, many people don't like the theory of unconscious also. They don't like to believe that they're motivated by little elements inside their system, that there may be
hormones, and there may be events that happened in their life that they forgot about that direct their thinking. Well, there's a very good parallel. They say that something is scientific. It's left the realm of theory.
Once it can be repeated, if you can lay down an equation or a hypothesis and it can be repeated, it's no longer a question of doubt if it can be repeated over and over again. If I tell you that if I throw a rock through a window, that it'll bust if I throw it hard enough, and it is a window as we know it, not a plastic or one of these new materials, that it will bust, and then I tell you, try throwing the rock through it, and the rock does break. It's you can't deny it. You see, we keep tying epistemology means the theory of truth. It's a separate category. Again, one of these fragmented elements of philosophy even has it. They call epistemology the theory of truth, man's mind and its relation to the exterior world. Well, the theory of the unconscious has elements of it, of its theory, elements of proof that are repeatable. There are things that can be done with the right circumstances, again and again and again and again and again, so it belongs to all mankind. And this is another element of genius, by the way, for people that are interested in getting recognition in art, that unless it gets to a stage of expressing certain things that mankind wants to belong to them, belong to your art object, and your art object wants to belong to them, then it may succeed. They take an individual, and they hypnotize him. They tell him that when he wakes up in the hypnotic state, that he should, on hearing of a certain word like, I'll use bottle, something that's in the room here, that if I lift this bottle up, you'll go over and you'll open a door. Well, what happens is that when they do this, they find a strange thing happening after the, I'll mention the word bottle, or they use it, Freud used the example of when he said he touches necktie and say, oh, this necktie is too tight or something like that, that he'd go and open the window. Well, what would happen is the man would go and he would go and open that window when he did that. And then they turn to him and say, why did you open that window? And he'd say, well, because it was stuffy in here. It was hot in here. He'd have a whole bunch of things that Freud calls rationalizations. Because everybody there knew that he was given a suggestion. This is what they call it technically now. They don't use the word hypnosis in scientific circles. They call it suggestion. And they don't say that you've been hypnotized, but that you've been given a suggestion. Because this takes into account the fact that hypnotism had overtones of the fact that you could convince someone unwillingly to do something. But they found out in the course of things that if someone had grave objections to something, they wouldn't do it, like, kill somebody when I touch my necktie. And they wouldn't do that, because it violated too many elements of their psychology. So they use the word suggestion now. But you see, there is an unconscious on that type of proof. There is other proofs, but I don't want to go into just the theory of the unconscious, because I am talking about the dialectics of liberation. So you see that we have the relativity, the evolution, the social nature of mankind, and the unconscious. Now what happens? There's a dialectic, though. These things just don't get spewed out. There's a whole reaction to them. Now we got people that are over here on the side of reality. They're not on the side of man, what I call now, I can advance to another description of this, of humanity. I tend to think that any definition of mankind that evades the old Epicurean theory of the pleasure-pain analysis of mankind is a theory that is escaping one of the most fundamental realities of the nature of mankind. You can build a theory on these principles, but you can never exclude these principles. But many, many theories have been built this in this way. Now, why I don't want to get too off now here, wait a minute. Why are they on the side of reality? Well, you see that certain people gain advantages out of the situation. Like, for instance, I'll be very frank, certain clerics or religious people, you give me your carrots, and I'll give you the ectoplasm. You give me the labor that you create out in the field all day long, the potatoes and the rest of the items that we're going to say are worthless, materialistic items, and then we'll hand you back all kinds of theories about your salvation in another world. We'll give you all kinds of theories about the destiny of mankind, how beautiful it's going to be when you're not around, either on the other side of the grave
in another world, a Platonic world of ideas, or in a future generation. So you see that this is understandable. So what happens here? Here's the dialectic over here. For relativity, we have a middle class theory. I call it that because that's the most. This is where it comes from mostly. But they completely misunderstand the theory of relativity. They tend to block off the forces of each of these theories. They're too strong for civilization to withstand. So you say that relativity means that I can think anything I want. I can believe anything I want, and it's all right. Because if you think that way, and I think that way, it's all right. But Einstein pointed out that you can't have relativity without a yardstick. You can't have relativities of speed and space and things like this without some kind of a constant that you're measuring it by. So he made a constant in his theory called life. Now, this has a two-part aspect to it. It's arbitrary how we select life, but at the same time, it's necessary to have some starting point. In evolution, they try to say that mankind, oh, it may be true that mankind evolved, but there were certain elements that didn't evolve in him. There were certain things that never changed within him. And so you had an attempt to circumvent that. Or they built up circular theories in an absolute sense. They said that everything just turned around and went back where it came from. So give up. Then on the social nature of mankind, it's sure he's social. He's, you know, you can get a group of people together and you can utilize them to throw them into war. You can utilize them to do anything. You can use anything. In other words, it reverses the very intention of this. It's not an opposition to the absolute individual. It becomes an opposition that to the individuals that it is intended to help. And the theory of the unconscious has been twisted today into the theory that, wow, if some artist, for instance, if he starts exposing some unconscious material in his work, wow, watch out for that. And how many artists today watch out for the fact that they don't want symbols that may have sexual references, or they may have references to any of the elements I spoke of, the matrix here, outside of their painting? And this is why sometimes, well, sophistication is actually part of the dialectic. We get so alive with this idea of reality and what is outside there that we forget what's inside there. We want to have a successful severance of this. We don't want our art to reflect any types of what's been categorized in the psychology books as neurotic or psychotic, and it's a very common thing for a person to run from certain abstract presentations of work, just what I call modern wallpaper to a certain extent. You can, you know, make the walls real nice with a picture. To get into elements that might express the dynamics of your living. You see, I spoke of what is greatness? What is mankind call great? And it's this regrouping of forces back again that we try to escape things that may start to express the fact that we're caught in a matrix, that we're caught in a situation that is we're not comfortable with. And we even arrive at the conclusion to display discomfort is bad. So we end up like being a bunch of zombies, and as McLuhan says, we end up as being sleepwalkers. We're somnambulists. We walk around denying the whole world, denying the very existence of things, and we start to use these theories now. You see, they're no longer bringing us back to this. They've been around 100 years, so we tend to reverse the flow, the effect of them. We start to say, well, you think that means this and that means that, and you're caught in your bag is another theory. You know, this is one of the crudest dimensions of Einstein's theory of relativity, that we're caught in bags. I think maybe the baggy advertisements or something might have contributed to this, although I know it was around before that. This is a collaboration between commodities and our thinking, where they seem to come up with an advertisement for baggies, and then people walk around talking about bags. That actually there is no separation of any element from any other element. You see that if you break your body down, if I break, say for instance, I take you and I analytically now, and I'm speaking mentally, not in a physical sense, that if I break your body down, I go down into cells. I break the cells down, I'm into molecular structures. I break the molecular structures down, I'm into atoms. And then finally, I break the atoms down into electromagnetic field. Now, it's very strange, if I take a chair, the same thing I've done to you, and I break that down, it's made out of electrons, it's made out of atoms, and I break that down into field. So you see that, to a certain extent, these divisions we've made don't carry through in a complete sense. Now, I was going to speak of individuality. How does individuality fit into the dialectics of slavery? Well, quite frankly, it doesn't fit into the dialectics of slavery, because slavery is based on a mass adherence to a certain pattern. And this is why thinkers can create systems over and over again. There was Schopenhauer created a system called the world's will and idea. Isn't that funny? You could get two words to express things. You could get Hegel wrote books called The Philosophy of History. You see, in other words, he can get, the thinkers can start getting things down into a mass behavior pattern. They can start like an ocean. They can say it has a high tide at this time and it has a low tide at that time. Then they turn around to you and in other methods, they can say that you have high tides and you have low tides. That you have illusions about the tides and everything and are subject to the reverse effect of these theories here. Now, individualism is an interesting question. It's a question that, strangely enough, arises mostly in our society, I think, more than any other. Historically, I'm trying to recall where it became such a problem, and I would tend to think that it never did become such a problem. You can read all of Plato. You can read a lot of the ancient thinkers of Greece. You can read the thinkers of many, many periods, and it didn't become the problem that we're talking about today. For Plato, in a certain sense, he said that the whole world was moving to a good. You know, this is abstract. Who knows what is good? But in a certain extent, get into that. He said the whole world's moving to a good. He didn't talk about everybody moving toward an individuality. Everybody's moving toward the good. And he built a system that said that certain things were good and they weren't, and other things weren't, toward justice. Well, I believe that the only way that we can gather up an individuality out of the whole dialectic that I've tried to describe here of individuality is that we're talking about almost like a decathlon. That we all have certain common attributes, common not only with each other but with nature. But it's a question of the people that are heading in first to the recognition of the situations, the representations for artists of the situation. I don't mean that they turn art into propaganda or anything like that. I feel that if they relaxed a little bit and stopped getting so rationalistic about what they're doing, that maybe they would come out with something. It doesn't have to be a system or a whole school waving over this year it's that school and another year it's another school. You know, why don't you start your own school? And where does it come from? Somebody just says he's going to paint a tomato can. He's going to paint that. Now, if a man could get somewhere with painting a tomato label, then certainly you could get anywhere with anything. That's proof that you've canceled out all this great theory about how you're going to, say, recapitulate the fame of Van Gogh or the fame of whatever area you pick, whatever school. You see, this is what I feel individualism is. Historically, because remember what I said. I can't put things back into little shells. I can't say that I'm going to say this is where something is. Because we've been taught already that nature is dynamic, it's relative, it's evolutionary, that it has unconscious forces that we don't even know about. So we can't even, when we construct something academically, we don't know what other things went into it. We don't know how much we've dragged into it that we aren't aware of. So that we can't just make separations anymore. We can't call individuality a goal in itself in the way that it's formally been thought of, this uniqueness. You see, all you're doing is recapitulating the whole element of the dialectic of slavery. That ultimately the dialectic of the theory of individuality becomes the ally of the very thing that you're struggling against. Somebody once pointed out in a book that man is the neurotic ape. That's a definition of him. You could switch from that from Aristotle's theory that he's a rational animal. And you could say he's an erotic ape because he's the only animal, I'm not putting in his words, the man that said this now, because he's the only one that's so concerned, that's so involved in hacking himself to bits, hacking himself away from all the elements that these four great thinkers who represent, as I said before, I'm not saying that they're the only ones that thought this, but I'm picking four individuals, Freud, Einstein, Marx, and Darwin, who try to regroup the reality of man and the world that he lives in. Some people don't like a little element of this one or a little element of that. That's irrelevant. We're talking about the things that are common in him, the same thing that's being said. And if you could tell Einstein that he's saying the same thing as someone else, does he consider that an objection to his individuality? No. He considers it a situation that's complementary to him. In fact, if you look up in the biographies of any individual that was creative, if it was pointed out to him that someone else did what he did before, and he's getting all the accolades right now, he says, isn't that wonderful? You see, because he's not driving for a fragmented world. He's not looking for this, if you draw it to its ultimate conclusion, he's not looking for the isolation chamber. He's not looking for the man that's been completely separated and disintegrated in all three areas. Separated I don't want to use philosophical terms that will confuse you, but not that I doubt that some of you do are pretty good in philosophy, but man separated from his world. You see, he's fragmented that way. He looks at things, and like Newton said, and all mankind up to that time said, there's a certain time going on in the world. There's a certain space in the world that all things belong in. And we're like some stranger that was thrown into the whole mess here. And on the sidelines, God wound the whole clock up. He got out a crank. He cranked it up and threw you in the gears to find out if you could get out the other end of the clock. And then he give you some kind of a reward. And then you have the theory of evolution here, that we are connected. You see that no man that would come up with a theory of evolution. You know that who was it now, an ancient Greek? I'm thinking, Anaximander had a theory of evolution. If someone told Darwin that Anaximander had the theory, there would be no objection. So you see that in the drive, sometime in the art, the realm of art, the drive that we're creating for ourselves, we're picturing a goal that isn't consistent with a history of known achievements of mankind's intelligence. What we call unique, in many instances, what we call creative, isn't necessarily the isolation of ourselves in our work, which we're defining it as, really. I have to bring it into that kind of a definition. We're saying that we're dragging like some kind of a dog in a certain way. We're dragging, they say that when you don't believe in the theory, strangely, that you're not separating man from nature, but in a lot of ways we're repeating lower elements. We're like the dog, if you set a piece of meat out, and they're in the semi-wild stage. They want to drag it off into different corners. They want to eat their food over there, and this one wants to eat its food over there. Well, you see, this is what we're doing in many instances. And I've covered the social and talking about the evolutionary. Then the idea that we should hide, this is another part of it. See, this is all the dialectic I'm going into. The idea that we should start hiding things, that we should start refining the art that we create, or the intellectual achievements that we think from mankind, is actually placing yourself in a position of retreating from the very things that mankind is striving for. In the history of mankind, do you realize that at one time you said that the sun was not revolving around the earth, they would have burnt you to death? So that when we say certain things that we're afraid our society will burn us to death for, that we're retreating from the very greatness we're pretending to. We're running from the very examples of mankind's achievement. We know that Freud had to be ransomed out of Germany. Einstein didn't get, well, he had to leave Germany, he left Germany, that many, the history of thinkers, Hegel pointed out, is a history of unhappiness to a certain extent. It's a history of the individual struggling against the group concept, and there's where the individuality comes in. It doesn't come in when you're obeying thy neighbor, the reality. When you're doing things that you're expected to do, you're doing things that your training bothers you with if you violate. This isn't what we're, this isn't how the things themselves have been created. So you see, I've fallen into a paradox myself. I talk about the dialectics of slavery, and I bring up, in a certain sense, the elements of liberation. I discuss the role of the artist, the role of the scientist, the role of the thinker. But you see, this is exactly what we're involved in, a world of contradiction. I don't mean contradiction in the sense of thought, a contradiction that extends to the very nature of things. That, like, for instance, I'll draw an example from a science, geology, that I read recently in a geology book, that the surface of the Earth is a result of two contradictory forces going on. Forces from within the planet, the shrinkage because of the loss of heat, and because of forces acting on the planet. So we get changes taking place. And you see, contradiction is the very nature of change. You can't have change with complete monolithic harmony. And yet this is sometimes when we want to make a break to creativity. We want to make it, but we want the acceptance of the person around us. We want the social order to say, yes, yes, that's all right. But you see, if they are saying, yes, yes, it's all right, then you know you're right back in here and you're not making the advance. If you're going to paint things, if you're going to create things that are acceptable alone on that standard, I'm not saying that things have a divergent element of acceptance to it, but if that is the criteria, acceptance, then you're already violating the very premise of the thinker. And you know in the history of art itself that many artists' works were laughed at, they were scorned, the artist was driven into a semi-state of despair in certain instances. Like, take the most common thing, I'm not working in the realm of painting now, but in the realm of music, that when Tchaikovsky first wrote, now he's a tame little lamb running around, they said that the score he wrote for the Swan Lake is nobody can dance to that, they said. You can't do it, it's an undanceable item. And today it's the most danceable thing around. They've had dissonance, and then they call it harmony in another year. You see, so in a certain extent, the achievement that you're striving for, if you're striving for an artistic achievement, isn't always an endorsement that lies right in your environment, because you're somehow caught up in the same thing that the Egyptian artist was. You're still painting the Pharaoh's face. You're still following the law. At that time, they would make a law, and they say they'd kill you without doing it. Today, the dialectics of slavery has a new method. We'll create a subtle moral undercurrent in the population, and we'll squash the individual out in that sense. Now, you have to bring up another problem also. This was brought up by a philosopher called Friedrich Nietzsche. I don't know, am I extending myself too far? It was a philosopher called Friedrich Nietzsche, and he said that Darwin was all wet. Let me bring up some dialectics, throw it in there. Now here I am listing him as one of the great individuals. He said he was all wet because Darwin said it's the survival of the fittest. The survival of the fittest species, by the way, not the fittest individual, as has been twisted into. Nietzsche said that this isn't what's going on in civilization. What you've got going on in civilization is the survival of the most sheepish elements, the elements that cringe before the social authority that is constantly enforcing a certain reality principle, whether it's Nazi Germany, the United States, the Soviet Union, or any other political aggregate or social aggregate. And then what happens is that we have a successful individual defined in terms of how he makes the mechanics of the reality work, independent of the fact of how much pain he may create, how much pleasure he may deprive the human race of. So that you can get individuals creating art to glorify pharaohs in one period, and art to swim in the tide of the society that we live in today. A society like, for instance, at this moment, enforces certain things, not as a conspiracy or not as a fully rational thing, because you have to take into consciousness what Freud, into awareness what Freud spoke of, the unconscious, the training that will make you work in acceptable ways. It will make your art almost follow a predictable pattern. And the surprises even are predictable. You have a situation which perpetuates the withdrawal of man into his isolation chambers, and then we have to pay the penalty for it. We pay the penalty in the evidence I spoke of before, the evidence that in one half of a century we have war waving on war and war, and people sit down and say, well, it's evil governments, and some people say it's evil this, and it's evil that. You see, we're still conceptualizing. We're still saying there's something left in this reality that we can salvage. There's something there. If we could only work it out, it would be all right. It reminds me of a situation of a guy that built a clock out of straw, and it didn't work. And he kept on worrying about how he could move the straw around so that the clock would work. But you can't, and you see, the very foundation of the dialectics of slavery is to keep the center of activity over here on the reality, to keep it down here on the both matrices that I described before, keep you as genitally heterosexual as possible in the metapsychology of Freud. We need to keep people in alliances and families, like we need a mother and a father. We need a child that knows that his mother and father are different from other adults. They're different people. And you know, there are stages where people can witness this at 4 years old or 3 years old. Kids will come into a strange environment and they'll hang on the parent. They're suspicious of everything around them. Because they've already been taught, you see, by that age, that certain people are different from other people. They've already been fragmented. So we can trace the problem down very, 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 very far. We can trace it down to training that ran people on a clock. This is fragmenting. This is, McLuhan called the clock a hacking of the organism of time. He believes in the unity of nature to a certain extent. He said in one of his books, Understanding Media, that man is the animal. He made a definition too, that eats when it's time to eat, not when he's hungry. This is his great achievement, that he fragments his time fragments his life. Do you see that at one stage, they don't do that now, I know it's a new thing. You know, they've always got to jump off something that hurts too much. When they had a lot of problems, they jump into a new theory. They're always trying to find a way to circumvent the forces of these theories here. You get a child that, like I said, that has these alliances in his head. So how far is he in the very family structure that we glorify, that preaches alliance, not by conscious things, but by all the training and the circumstances of the family itself, that preaches the alienation of you from the rest of humanity, that makes it uncomfortable? Like today I feel in the general, I'm making a speculative thing, I haven't done any field study or read any field study, although I like to keep close to evidence, I'll make a journey out, that one of the obsessions of this generation is an obsession of how you come on to your neighbor. This is the dialectics of slavery. You got to worry about your own humanity facing another person's humanity. And the whole lexicon, the whole vocabulary, that word means, the whole vocabulary of the things that we say today are distortions of these theories or oppositions to these theories, a complete attempt. And we say that we're making breaks with the old, like they say, don't trust anybody over 35. I tend to agree with that myself to a certain dimension, but not always, because I've met many, many people that are more radical in a certain sense than what I call the young fogies, the people that are just trying to recapitulate the adult pattern with new clothes on. So your grandmother wore a dress down to the floor and you're going to wear it up around your knees. You're holding on to certain elements of our time today. And they bother you. You see, because of the unconscious, they bother you because of the social nature of man as it is, They bother you because we don't really like to see, in many instances, eroded away all this little training that we had drummed into our heads as a child. We regret almost every stage of the intellectual advance that we made. We don't like to really, we all say this word. This is the big word in our vocabulary. But none of us practically believe it. We all say that I'm real, real liberal about this. This is this thing. And then, you know, we say, what a fool this individual is. Or what a jerk, or how stupid, or how ignorant, or how we recapitulate. I'm saying it, trying to say it in the common words that we use today. I don't know if I'm succeeding, but they teach you. You're the children that they teach that people burnt Galileo at the stake. You're the people that are taught that they laugh at the inventive genius of mankind, and then you turn around and repeat the same things that you were taught were so horrible. Because society is safe now. It's safe from laughing at the genius that died 500 years ago, but they're worried about the guy that's walking around today. So we tend to associate mental difficulties or other refined methods of getting around the old witchcraft or diabolical possession. Now, like, take two words, for instance, I think that should be brought back into new light. This is a little reaction in a certain sense to what we're talking about. Our society is moving in a direction. On the surface of it all, people have to prove it's the opposite. It's like I said before, it's the things you got to deny. You can't deny, not the things that you got to accept. That you have a civilization that's moving in a certain direction toward nuclear conflagration. So we have a word in our vocabulary we never even thought of reconsidering. It's the word deviation. Now this means just to divert from a course, to move away from that course. So you see, in a certain sense, I'm not playing on words now, that we can't make any progress until we have more deviation. Now they speak of another word that's used in psychology. These words are thrown around. Take the word perversion. I'll abbreviate it. That means that a socially defined goal, or any goal, like for instance, not approached, not in the sense of, like I spoke of before, it's diverted from the path, but it actually destroys the goal. It doesn't go after that goal anymore. It just moves off from its own ground. So you see, psychologically, you could say that what we need is a reincarnation of two of the most diabolical words in our language. If someone said that in the medieval period, that the devil is on the side of understanding and knowledge, that when he's tempted, using a very trite thing to bring it up to date, though, because trite things seem to be the biggest fleas in our face, the biggest problem that we face, that the devil tempted Eve, they say. We all probably can reject that story. He tempted her to taste of the apple of good and the knowledge of good and evil. So she ate it, and they built the whole metaphysics around it, the whole philosophy, and they built a whole religion around the idea that the devil had created this problem. He brought knowledge into the world of good and evil. And so 2,000 years of people accepted this theory, and the worst thing that you could say was that someone was a devil worshiper or something like that. But like I said before, how we tend to recapitulate the older generation with a new method. We tend to just change the hemline, keep the whole interior the same, change it from the ground and bring it up to the knee. We do the same thing with this situation here. We tend to believe that if we use certain words that aren't devil, but they really pack a lot of power in our society, deviant or pervert, or we bring in... we have a heresy. A heresy means you're just exaggerating a certain part of a given body of knowledge. In other words, if you give me a page and I take it out of context, I exaggerate something, I underline it, I underscore it, I throw ink on it, and I do everything. That's heresy in a pictorial way. That we can call someone a communist. You know, that's a heresy over here, I think. System that I'm really talking about. It's a deviation from a goal to a certain extent. But the point that I'm trying to build it up to is that the dialectics of slavery is based on the positive aspect of contribution to mankind
by certain thinkers who do not involve themselves in these myths of the age, who are not afraid to have them be repeating someone or to be recapitulating in a new mode with somebody else. And we have, on the other hand, a whole slew of things that are on the alliance of reality and words that reality uses to fight: devil, deviant, pervert, or communist, or fascist. You can throw pound out the window by calling him a fascist in certain circles. Did you know that? Just say that he was on the side of Mussolini in the Second World War, that, and then bingo, he's Pope, he stinks. And then you can take Bertrand Russell, and NYU did it. Don't say that I'm talking about ignorant people. You know what they did? They said that he couldn't come to NYU and teach there as a guest scholar because he wrote some essays that were immoral. They were called unpopular essays. But all he talked about in them anyway was that children should run around nude together, that we have a neurotic obsession with clothes. And they said, we don't want him in here. You know, NYU students can't face Bertrand Russell, even though he created all the system that he occupies a certain unique role. He creates all of the system for the reality, and then he sabotages it. He's like a guy down south, a white guy that sides in with us, as in quotation marks, that nigger lover. You know, he's the worst one. He's worse than the uppity nigger. Because the uppity nigger, he knew his place. He knew that when the master comes, you step into the gutter and let him get in. You get to the back of the bus. If you don't get to the back of the bus, you know, you're going to crack it. But they didn't have to get to that stage because you do it voluntarily. So the worst guy is the guy that knows their own system and then turns around and he puts a little sabotage into the mechanism. He throws, that comes from the Dutch word sabot for shoe, and they used to throw shoes into the machinery. That's how we get the word. And Bertrand Russell throws big shoes into the machinery. He throws bricks into their metaphysics, their theology. He wrote a book, Why I Am Not a Christian, that they haven't been able to swallow in certain conservative realms yet. Then you know what he does? He creates a justification for mathematics. He creates a system called symbolic logic with Whitehead, Principia Mathematica, he called it. And it was on many volumes, and it's filled. If you ever looked at it, it looks like a new language. It looks like the Chinese went sick and invented a new concept of their own language. And they religiously follow this. This is the Bible of the new era. You know, we're recapitulating again, bringing in the new elements to reinforce it. And then he turns around and he writes My Philosophical Development and other books, History of Western Civilization, which is out in paperback. You can buy that. And spread all through that, he says mathematics had a bad influence on philosophy. It tended to idealize the situation. We tended to make these arbitrary things that were cutting the world up. Here we're back to the unity of nature. The fact that nothing is fragmented. He says we start talking about one thing and adding it to another, and we make things, you know, that are successful in a certain limited area to a certain extent, limited in when you consider the whole history of mankind, and not the objects, the means of satisfaction of mankind's drive, like technology. This is dependent on this, and a lot of the things that are the mechanical brains today that they have are dependent on his system. But you see, all of these are means, and means always are slipping under in our conceptual consideration to the things that they're serving. You see, this is how you bring back this unity. You're not separating the ends from the means, but you're putting them in perspective. And this is how we avoid the idea that if we believe in the unity of nature, that we're all we believe that there is a glob. Some people say that all you believe now is that there's all this molasses, and it's just hanging there and mankind stuck in it. But this isn't the situation, you see. That we get perspective on things, and this is what thinkers are doing. This is how they're separating things. They're not separating them in a metaphysical sense. They're not making them a completely isolated phenomenon from the rest of nature. They're not making them an end in itself, or a thing that mankind should somehow turn into an oppression of himself. They are talking about a spotlight approach to reality to a certain extent, that what they're doing is we're dealing with a world that's so complex. You see, we're faced with a paradox. But the brain only occupies about 4 inches across or 8 inches or something like that. And this 8 inches
thinks that it's going to get the 15 or 16 billion light years out that our telescopes can see. I think it's theoretically 13 billion light years. And that we can get it into a position that it isn't going to bother us anymore. This reality, see, there's more than the dynamic of slavery here. We don't just have the separation of the pleasure principle and the reality principle. You see, the reality is always sending back temptations to break down a certain structure. That even the reality, see, there's actually, we can divide this in a certain sense. There's a reality of pleasure principle. Now, here's where we gain the unity of nature. In a formalistic sense, even though I don't like formulas, and there's a certain pleasure to reality. You see, so we got reality and pleasure we can put on both sides of the equation. Now, I don't know if this board is too messed up, but I'm going to clean the area here and I can bring this to a conclusion for questions. We have a reality over here and a pleasure over here. But you see, we can't make one fantasy and wishes and hopes and dreams and art objects even. We have to make it a reality. We have to turn the reality into a pleasure. Now, you say, how do you do that? Well, you see, remember before I told you that certain scientists in Germany created rockets for the Nazis, and then artists in the Pharaoh's time went along with the idea that they shouldn't create anything but the artist's face. I don't remember anybody being recorded as being... I know Ikhnaton came up with a new theory of God, and he got in a lot of trouble, but I've never heard of an artist getting in too much trouble. You don't seem to get in that much trouble in certain areas. They suffer. They don't get in trouble with certain of the conceptual things I'm talking about. Now, the connecting link, how do you do this then? Well, just as I connected the scientist and the artist together in the dialectic of slavery, they're also connected together in the promise of what he was speaking of earlier, the dialectic of liberation, the bringing about, the merging of a pleasure and pain analysis with reality, bringing the two halves together. You see, I had to involve my talk tonight in a certain fragmentation. I talked all night about the world being split apart and how that's a bad approach to things. But you see, since conceptually and culturally we split it apart, I have to work just in the sense that Bertrand Russell worked. He works with the system, and then you bring it to its conclusion, and then you make your critique, your assault on it, such as he has. We make a division here, a dichotomy between a pleasure and a reality principle. We have to bring them together. The artist brings them together, but I feel liberating his instinctual approach to things. He liberates his self from the very things that he says that he's against, from the mob pressure, the group, the mass, the gray element. That he says, oh, I want to be a different individual. I want to stand out from the rest of them. I don't want to be someone that ends up with a tombstone over me and I'm remembered for the length of time of my people that were my contemporaries and then it's forgotten. You all know you can walk through a colonial cemetery, right? Who the heck knows who those people are? And who the heck even cares, right? But, you know, those were the people that were passing all the judgments. They were saying, this one's a witch, and that one should be this and that. And who do we remember in history? We remember all the witches, we remember all the devils, and all the good people are laying under their stones, and nobody knows who they are. Can one person mention the name of an inquisitor? Could you tell me who was on the Inquisition of Bruno? Who put him to the stake? You can't tell me. But I can ask the question. I can't even tell you. I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that Bruno was there. I can tell you that much. And I can tell you that that's the only way, if you're interested in your in some type, I'm not condemning the individual that tries to have a goal in front of his eyes, but I am confused, to put it aptly, with the individual that talks about being a successful artist who's involved in nothing but changing hemlines. He's going from 1890 floor to 1960 knee. You see, you're involved, you're going to be in the same situation. You're ending up with that gravestone over your head that nobody knows who the hell was or is or whatever happened. Freud in one instance even said that when we discuss liberation of the instinctual world, that everything gets worried. The sequence of these words I brought up here, these are packed with dynamite, because there are diabolical words of today. That he says, suppose you're involved in these areas here, thinking-wise and physical, behavior-wise. Thinking is, well, I'm not going to alienate that either. Thinking is just another form of behavior. You can't have thought without a brain, any more than you can have digestion without a stomach. So you see, all your thinking is tied right into the body. All right. So you know what he said? He says that there, here's a graveyard. And you can imagine a situation where one gravestone has a voice coming out of it, and Sarah don't keep her house clean. John is running around with another woman. And you see, the whole absurdity of civilization comes to life. But we don't want, an element of liberation is, before you get to the stage where somebody could create a fantasy about that, a fantasy of gravestones worrying about Sarah's clean house or John running around with Sarah even, that we should apply it now. Like the old saying, it's a very, very trite saying, but I bring it in to illustrate the intellectual situation of a reconciliation with death and life, that a woman once said that I'd rather have one flower when I'm alive than a carload when I'm dead. And so you see, the situation is applicable here. Don't worry. You could see the absurdity here in the situation of people in the grave worried about what the other person is. It's really comical. But you're doing the same thing while you're alive. So you're like the person that's getting a carload of flowers when you're dead. You appreciate it now. You appreciate the lesson of that situation. But while you're alive, you don't. You see, you're still worried about that element. You're still caught up in the dialectics of slavery. You're caught up with the distortions of great theories that you're not even aware of sometimes. You're not aware of who thought up your thinking. I've heard him talk one time somewhere else, and he used a phrase I'd like to bring in. He says, I stole the language that I've got. You see, that what happens is that we are brought up in a culture. We're trained. And do you think that if we go through similar training, we go through similar experiences, that we could all of a sudden turn around and say, I want to be an individual, that it becomes a comedy? And Marx had something to say about comedies. He said that the first time it happens, it is a tragedy. The second time it happens, it's a damn comedy. You see? Because you're caught up in that situation I was talking about of how you're circumventing theories of evolution. This is why we're tying all these thinkers back in here. Darwin, you're back in the circle of eternal reoccurrence. And you know, the University of Basel in Germany gave Nietzsche an honorary degree in philosophy because of his theory of the eternal recurrence. Because he struck a tone, I feel, in a certain period, there was in German philosophy, there seemed to be a great expansiveness of people's minds in this period. You had Schopenhauer, you had Hegel, you had Immanuel Kant, you had Schiller, who wrote The Aesthetic Education, on the aesthetic education of the human race. Have any of you read that? This is something you should read. You're interested in art, you should read. What is aesthetics anyway? Why keep things separated again? Why? You're using your mind, as I pointed out already, to beat down social influences around you, your friends. You're worried about how you come on. How about you happy to paint your paintings, scared stiff of whether they'll be laughed at if you really did what you wanted to do. So you do something else, and everybody's looking at the other guys and sneaking a little of this, you know, not consciously, but you're keeping it group, and then you keep going around talking about how you have a big desire to be an individual. This will never work. It'll never work. And you know, the Japanese have an idiom that can't say that it'll never work. They say it'll never happen. And then you keep asking what's happening, man. You see, but the big thing is that it'll never happen, as they say when they try to speak English. It'll never happen. That you have to unite theory and the instinctual world, because they are separated. We can't jump out of the world we're in. We can't just run away from it. But instead of using theory to beat yourself down, use your theory to get yourself out. That's the big problem. Make an alliance. I spoke of a unity of the pleasure, pain, reality over here. Make an alliance between your thinking and your instinctual world. Make an alliance with all of the fragments that have been thrown apart. And you can succeed. And you can maybe accomplish something in the realm that you're talking about. I am more familiar, I admit, with the achievements of people in the intellectual realm, more so than in the artistic realm, although I am familiar to a certain extent with the history of art. And I end my talk here, and open it for questions, on this note that as long as you keep recapitulating, you know what the word recapitulating means? It means as long as you keep on bringing back some of the old, you know, you're bringing back that crutch, you're bringing back peanuts, like he walks around with a blanket. You know, and everybody looks at that and thinks it's cute. He drags a blanket around with him. It's some focus point of orientation. Get disorientated. The hell with the orientation point. You don't need the orientation. If you want to, break through the circle of eternal recurrence of the dialectic of slavery. Thank you.
I feel confident that you have many questions to ask of Mr. Tolan. Certainly has stirred a lot of cells in my own brain box, and I feel that he's done the same thing with yours. What do you have to say? This is your moment.
Where should we begin?
Where should we begin?
Begin at the end.
No, that's a see, now here would be a good practice. Now let's integrate the audience. You know, there's theories now in drama that they believe that we should integrate the audience into the action. That the idea that we should have the play entirely restricted away on a stage from the audience is dead. Let's involve yourselves in this situation. They don't necessarily have to be questions. Why don't you make statements, if you want, or opinions, or anything like that? Involve yourself in the situation that's here. Now, someone asked, where do we begin? Well, you know, any journey begins where you are. We know that much. And I don't think that I'm giving you too much help there because you're really asking me what the next step is. And the next step is not outward, but inward. The next step is coming to grips with the configuration that you call self. The configuration that I've already described in my talk as a culturally created object. An object that has thousands of years of a process behind it. It's been shaping and tinning it before you were born, creating each new development and stage of mankind that you were eventually to come from. That someone once brought up a point now of determinism. We tend to believe that we have a free will. Existentialists teach this. A lot of you people, too, I know that the minute you hear philosophy, you go run and pick up a book on existentialism because Francoise Sagan is one, and she's quite an illustrious personage, or maybe Sartre. And then you go and you read about all this language that you have a very difficult time. You read language, I mean, that you have a very difficult time reading. I don't deny that there are elements in existentialism, but it's comparable to a situation of reading far more than you're going to get out of it. I feel that existentialism, to a certain extent, represents certain elements of art that are, they have these desires to deviate from the course, they have certain desires to destroy the course, but they want to think about it so much that all we're doing is thinking about it. We're not doing anything. So as I gather the majority of you do paint, our artists, is that true? That there's nobody in here just dances or something like that. Well, you see that I try to bring up certain elements here before. I raise the situation that if someone can paint a Campbell soup label, then why should anybody be afraid of what they could put on a canvas after that? But yet, you see, a lot of your motivation is tied up with a fear. The fear of your classmate, the fear of, say, maybe the instructor. The fear of many, many things. And you keep on casing yourself in with fear. So overcoming a fear of asserting yourself is a step, yes?
I would disagree with that because it comes to the point where the artist is all alone with himself with the canvas and that there is nobody that can help him but himself and that white canvas that he has to do something about it. And that's where he is. The artist will be truthful to himself, and that the fear is no longer from anybody else but himself. That everybody that the what they collected from everybody is very much conscious and not unconscious. Mm-hmm. And that the audience is very much aware of what's happening at the time, and that the unconscious is, you know, separated from himself and the canvas. Mm-hmm.
Outside of Leonardo da Vinci and a few other people, I doubt whether artists have showed or displayed that much of a conceptual understanding of the world they live in. I don't deny that they do, but in a certain extent, let's not forget the very work that you're involved with. You're involved with symbols at some level, because there's no such thing as realism, you know that. Even the camera doesn't have realism, so to a certain extent, you are involved in symbolic representations. When you're drawing something, you're not drawing the thing as it is. There's a meeting of your mind and the thing you're striving to gain. And what happens is that we tend to either step away from it and say, there it is, and if anybody, we get defensive, we say, if anybody tries to interpret that, it's only their interpretation. And historically, I like to put it into perspective in a certain sense, that if I were in Egypt, at the time they could only paint the face of the pharaoh, and I said, well, look it. You know, everybody is going to run away from you if you paint someone else, because they don't want to be caught around an artist that paints a picture other than the face of the, I don't mean paint sculpture. It did extend to painting too on the walls to a certain extent, but not as great as it was in sculpture. That they'll run away from you. You see, then you'd ask, where would I begin? I'm worried about the Pharaoh's whip. I'm worried about the death that he could put me through. So, like I pointed before, we're refining things. Today we're not asking about the